Boketov. I just had to bring somebody to the airport now, so I just got back the second. Okay. I came back a day and a half ago. Yeah, thank you. Okay. 2 weeks ago, we, in the subject of the intertwine of rendezvous of science and Torah, so you can't help but not focus a little bit on the Rambam, who is such a personality of Torah Umada. Specifically, we mentioned a few things about Rambam in his as a physician. In this page that we have, this deals with a subject that already was germinating in my mind since I'm an 11th grader. And why would I come up with such a topic, science and Rambam Mishnah commentary? Well, I wasn't familiar at the time with how much scientific information the Rambam already has in his early writing called the Mishnah commentary, Perush HaMishnah. But I had an 11th grade teacher, a Rebbe, who taught me a very, very good lesson. And that is, if you don't know something, tell the students that you don't know it. He taught me this lesson by negative reasons. He never realized that he's supposed to tell his students, I don't know something. He thought that would be embarrassing. Chazal say, Lemad lishoncha lomar eni yedea. Teach yourself to say the phrase, I don't know. I don't know is very humbling. And for a teacher, sometimes standing in front or sitting in front of students, you figure that that's not the thing you're supposed to be saying. You're supposed to know everything. It's not true. Neither a teacher nor a parent not supposed to know everything. You know what you know. And if a teacher is faced by a question and does not know, then it's a very, very educational thing to do to tell the students, okay, let's try to figure it out together. And that's good. That makes for good education. You know, you use a library, you use a Beit Midrash, today you use the internet, whatever you use, whatever your tools are, you teach the students how to find the information. Thank you very much.
Do you want one or two sukkahs?
If one is fine. One is fine.
Two if you want.
No. So what happened was, this particular Rebbe, in the yeshiva that I went to in Borough Park, Yeshiva High School, we studied Lumud HaKodesh, general Hebrew, Lumud HaKodesh, Gemara, and other things, from 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And then general studies from 3 o'clock to 6:30. So it was a very long day, especially we had to go to Minyan in the yeshiva at 7:30, which means we're out of the house from 7 to 7, essentially. It was a 12-hour day, which was okay, we survived it. And in the afternoon studies, which included, sciences and mathematics and literature and geography and history and whatnot, we pretty much took the subject seriously because we had the New York State Regents exams to take, which was some matriculated tests. We had aspirations of going on to university. So this Rebbe thought it would be a smart thing to tell us in 11th grade that if not for the fact that the government requires that we have general studies, all of what we're doing in the afternoon hours is basically Bittul Torah. This is what he thought. This was an important thing to tell us. Now, first of all, I today, obviously we challenge that, but let's even assume the man believed it. It was a pretty dumb thing to say to students who are taking their studies seriously. I mean, here you just take the motivational balloon and you just bust it. Anybody, we were basically being told that everything we're doing in the afternoon hours is an avera. It's a bittul Torah. So, even if he believed it, and he should have kept it to himself at the time, but he thought he was being smart and he's, teaching us the truth. So a student, it wasn't me, raised his hand and said, Rebbe, but the Rambam studied general studies and sciences and so on. That was a pretty good question. Yeah. So here comes the brilliant answer of the Rebbe. Says the Rambam began studying his general studies after he was 50 years old. Okay, which means basically you're now 17 years old. You have plenty of time yet, over 20 years, over 30 years yet, before you can crack a math book, a science book, and it wouldn't be regarded as Bittul Torah. That's only if you're on the level of the Rambam, that you've achieved by age 50 what the Rambam achieved. Okay, we were naive, and nobody questioned at what age did the Rambam begin studying general studies. But it was a point that was accompanying me for many, many years. Until I learned the truth. The truth is that the Rambam began studying general studies from very early on in life, parallel to any of other studies of Limud HaKodesh. So we can sometimes measure at what age a person started studying, or estimate what age, because you can, if he produced works. So the Rambam puts out, today we use the word published, those days there were no publishing houses, but if the Rambam puts out over 40 books in his lifetime, of which the entire Mishneh Torah, which is the Rambam's classic halachic work, that by his own admission took him 10 years to write, is counted as one book, even though he divides it into 14 volumes, but it's counted as one in the counting of the 40. So we know of the Rambam's Torani, halachic writings, being the Mishneh commentary, the Sefer Mitzvot, the Mishneh Torah, perhaps you'll include already the Gaita Perplex in this counting, and some of the famous letters which can count as books, which are very, very long-winded letters. You're not going to get to 10, which means at least 30 of the 40 are non-Torani books, most of them in the philosophical, most of them actually in the medical, general health areas. The Rambam wrote books, and he edited all kinds of encyclopedias and condensed them into smaller volumes. The Rambam was very, very prolific. This is a man without secretarial assistants, no computer, as far as I remember, 800 years ago, no computer. He did this all by himself. It's amazing. With not much, to turn to, not such a library. Some of the stuff he even wrote on the boat, but it was really no books to turn to, and everything's by memory. So it's astonishing, is an understatement, superhuman. Rambam's accomplishments are superhuman. But when we study the Rambam's Torani works, so the earliest works that the Rambam talks about that he wrote, he was 17 years old, and he wrote two different commentaries on Gemara. Now, where exactly are those books today? They unfortunately were lost. They were lost because in Egypt they weren't copied sufficiently adequately, and books in those days, a manuscript that were not copied and spread for more copies, got lost. So how do we know of their existence? Number one, the Rambam tells us in letters that he wrote such books. Number two, fragments of such books were surfaced in the Cairo Geniza of the 1890s. So there we discover almost the entire Perush to Masechet Rosh Hashanah and sporadic pages of his commentary of the entire Shas. It's sporadic pages. Somebody published it in 1962, Perush Rambam Talmud. And it's a small book, and obviously he wrote much, and much of it unfortunately was lost. But what we do find in the Rambam's own writings is that he wrote not one but two commentaries on the Gemara at this young age. One, he explains the hard words of the Gemara, and the second is more expansive, where he's dealing with subject matter. It's almost like he writes his own Rashi and Tosfot. He writes his own Rashi and Tosfot, stuff that went on in northern France and Germany, and Ashkenaz. The Rambam did all by himself. It's amazing. And much of this material was lost. This is at age 17. But the Rambam does not begin writing at 17. The earliest known book that the Rambam puts out, he's 16 years old, and it's a dictionary on terms of logic. Terms of logic is a discipline of philosophy. Now, when you write a dictionary, a professional dictionary, for example, I remember seeing at home a medical dictionary. Right? You want a medical dictionary so that when the doctor talks to you, you know, Chinese, you understand what he's talking about. Or if somebody was, you go to, let's say, an ulpan. So a young immigrant, an ulpan, he will not just learn Hebrew enough to get along in the makola in the morning. That was probably as a general ulpan that they'll give to people who are not going to be working in this country. So you have to know how to get on a bus and how to go to the post office and how to go to the bank and how to buy, you know, shoko and lachmaniyot at the makolet. Fine, but if you're planning to be a professional, so there are ulpanim designed for your specific trade. So if you're an electrician or plumber, you go to an ulpan that will focus on the vocabulary of electricians and plumbers. So who writes the book? Who writes the material, the syllabus for such an ulpan? Obviously a plumber, an electrician. You have to know somebody who knows the field, who's going to know the language. So too, if somebody's going to write a dictionary on logic, which is a discipline of philosophy, a person has to be already a philosopher. He has to be known in the field. So at age 16, the Rambam is already writing a dictionary on the logic. 16. He's already studied philosophy to the extent that he's competent enough to write a dictionary of all the various terms. That in itself is for sure very, very fascinating. So I never had that book. It's called Milon Higayon. Milon Higayon, Dictionary of Logical Terms, a treatise on logic. But I remember several years ago when they had the book fair, the Shavua Sefer, right down the block next to the Inbal in the Liberty Bell Park. So I saw it on some shelf. Somebody was selling it. It turns out it's a little chuver, it's a little not a, it wasn't even hardcovered. And it said Milon Higayon. This was it. Here I put my hands on it. I said, "How much does this cost?" They said 5 shekel. I said 5 shekel. For the Rambam's first work? I mean, this is like an important piece. I can give it 5 shekels, give it away. I'll give it 20 shekel for it. So I told the guy, "Yeah, at least 20 shekel." She said, "Fine, take this 20 shekel. I'll give you 4. Nobody was buying the Milon Higayon that day, you know? I was the only weirdo looking to book it to buy this. No, I only want one, but I think it's just an embarrassment that you're selling it for 5 shekel. You know, it's like a giveaway. I'm actually a giveaway. You're almost asking me to pay to take it. So we know that the Rambam was a scientist, a philosopher, early in the game, which means he didn't start studying at age 16. He started studying before 16. Certainly not before 50, that's for sure. Now, in those days, it's not like today, where people specialize in areas of science, in areas of medicine. I remember one of my sons, who today is a pilot, but we knew that he was going to be a paratrooper because at 2 years old, he was already jumping off the refrigerator in the house. So we saw he had potential. So in school, you know, you have these gymnastic rings and so on. Sometimes you slip and you fall, and as it was, he slipped, he fell, whatever. You know, he thought he may have a broken finger. Take him to the Kupat Chulim, to the x-ray, So we're waiting for the results of the x-ray, and I'm watching, and the other people who came after us, they're already getting results. That's always a nice, comfortable feeling. So I go over to the desk, and I said, you know, why isn't that the x-ray of my son's fingers? Because the radiologist who sees feet is in right now. You need a radiologist who sees hands. I said, listen, I need a radiologist who sees left pinkies. You know, just make sure he went specially to school just to look. You mean to tell me a radiologist who can tell you, you read feet, can't tell you if there's a break in a finger? I mean, I was appalled. Okay. So, you know, specialization. But days at a Rambam, we did not have specialization. It didn't exist. So if you were a scientist, you were what we call in Hebrew, kol boinik, you were everything. So it didn't differentiate yet into biology and chemistry and physics and astronomy. You were everything. Whatever science had to offer, that's what you were. And you were a mathematician and a doctor. Yeah.
Having him starting at 16, what do we know about his father and his education that he got?
We don't know that his father, Rabbeinu Maimon, was into the sciences. We don't know that. But we do know that the Spaniards were into science and philosophy. It wasn't uncommon. See, if you would take, let's say, Ashkenaz, that would be a very uncommon thing. And there was a personality who one of my daughters wrote a doctorate on. That's Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, who was a biblical commentator. And he was a scientist. He was an astronomer. He was a botanist, a zoologist, everything, the works. Because most of the Chachmei Ashkenaz, who we are familiar with, Rashi and his family, the Balei HaTosfot, they were busy growing grapes and making wine. They were in the business. The Rav Sam Chaim Soloveitchik did a master's thesis just on this, on the wine industry of Ashkenaz and the questions of the Ayin Nesach and so on. But they weren't really philosophers. In Spain, they were. So we don't know about Rabbeinu Maimon's activities, but that he would be encouraging of his son studying? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not like the Rav Zichron of the Bracha coming out of the Soloveitchik house where Rav Chaim, the grandfather, had zero interest in the general education. Zero. So it's interesting to know what happened to the Rav, how it happened. There's an answer to that question, but that would be interesting. But to the Rambam, he came from an environment that favored study of sciences, no doubt. So the Rambam, at age 23, sets out on a journey to write a commentary on Mishnayot. It takes him 7 years. Okay, so age 23 to age 30. And this is a work that I myself did, my own doctorate at Bar Ilan. We're comparing the Rambam's decisions in, halakhic decisions in the Mishnah commentary, to the Mishnah Torah. And there are many, and I'm trying to find out what the methodological things that were guiding him. But sometimes when you do an academic work, a scholarly work, so you come up with all kinds of side issues. So one of the side issues that I had, that I kept my eye on at least, was when the Rambam quotes science, refers to science, or uses science to help him understand a Mishnah, or to help us understand perform a halakha. And it turns out that from the beginning to the end of Rambam's Mishnah commentary, there are over 60 citations, direct references to science. And this is age 23 to 30. So again, he's not 50 years old, plus. He's young, and he's already referring to all these various sciences. For example, when he deals with Masechet Kelayim, which deals with inbreeding of different plants and vegetation, the Rambam is a botanist, and you can see it, he's a botanist. When he deals with Masechet Eruvin, you can see he's an engineer. And when he deals with Masechet Rosh Hashanah with regard to Kiddush HaChodesh, you see he's an astronomer. So in all these various Masechtot, where the need for general studies, general education, becomes critical for the understanding of halakha, the Rambam's there. So we have on the page here is 18 sources that most of them, 17 out of 18, from the Pirush HaMishnah, Mishnah commentary, and showing the Rambam as a proficient scientist in different areas. So let's take it from the top. I'm not sure we're going to finish this today. We'll carry on next week with this page. Source number one shows us that when the Rambam, in the Mishnah commentary, which simply means explaining the Mishnah, the Rambam gave us four reasons why he wrote the Mishnah commentary. One is to explain the hard words and the hard concepts. It's a forerunner of Kahati by 800 years. I mean, today people won't use the Rambam. They'll open Bilchus Kahati and they'll get the same thing. The second is, there's a dispute in the Mishnah, just give us a heads up where the halakha is moving. Is it to this view or to that view? So the Rambam is saying something on halakha. Two, the Rambam says, if you're going to study the Gemara, you use my Perush as an introduction to the Sugya. And four, if you've studied the Gemara and you just want to review the ideas, you can use my Perush and it'll serve also as a very healthy review. So those are the four reasons that the Rambam gives us in why he writes the Mishnah commentary. Now what he does also is he digresses here and there whenever there's room for amplification of some matter that's important to him. And philosophy was important to him. So if you take a look at source number one, it comes from the very end of Masechet Brachot, and he says, Avodivrei philosophim hamumchim bephilosophia. You know, there are some philosophers who are not experts. But if you talk about the really, really, really experts in philosophy, binyan zeh, hu davar nifla me'od v'amok me'od. He says he's commenting on a subject matter in the Mishnah itself that digresses to a philosophical idea that the Rambam himself says is very, very deep. And at the end of this section, of source number one, underline, the Rambam apologizes why he's being so expansive. The truth is, going off on a tangent here was not necessary in order to simply understand the Mishnah. My normal way of doing things, everywhere in this book, where there's some type of reference to a matter, an article of faith, I'm going to explain it. It is more important for me to explain the fundamentals of Judaism more than anything else that I'm teaching. So if an opportunity presents itself in the Perush HaMishnah to digress because what's up for grabs is explanation of something very, very central to Yahdut, to Judaism, I'm going to do it. So he's apologizing. He said, look, I know I've taken you off the track, but I'm doing it for a good reason. And let's see how this pans out in source number two. Source number two comes from the very end of Shas. We've jumped from the beginning to the end. Masechet Kelim, which is in Sefer Taharot. And in Sefer Taharot, the Rambam is talking about different kelim, vessels, with regard to its ritual purity or not, Tumah and Tahara. And there, the Mishnah in the 30th chapter talks about a vessel that's called Spaklaria. And Spaklaria is a glass vessel that the Rambam is going to tell us has a curvature to it. So he's going to explain to us what curves lenses are all about. And you'd think you're sitting by the eye doctor getting a prescription for glasses, and the optician who's going to grind the lens to the requisite number. So he takes the word spaklaria, and source number two, and he says, Huha masach, it's like a screen, but it's a glass screen. Sha'osim kideshi u'atzurot macharav. You can see through it, you can see the other side. Vehi ledati mila murkevet. This word, spaklaria, is apparently a word that's fused together with two words. Spaklaria, safek liriya. What you're seeing is something that's doubtful, which means it's imprecise. What you're seeing on the other side is not exactly what you think you're seeing, because the curvature of the lens is distorting the exact vision. Now, when we have eyeglasses, the curvature is distorting deliberately to correct a distortion the other way around. So either you have plus or minus, you're far-sighted and nearsighted. So if you're you're seeing poorly in a particular way, the physician is going to prescribe a curved lens that's going to negate that distortion. So it's basically a distortion the other way, and that's what it is. You take, for example, I'm sure if you've gone to a circus. So they have sometimes these mirrors that are bent in a certain way. That when you look in the mirror, you don't see yourself as you are, but you see yourself taller, you see yourself shorter, you see yourself fatter, you see yourself thinner. I mean, it's a great way to go on a diet, just to look at this mirror and see yourself very thin. Except the minute you walk away from the mirror, the whole thing's an illusion. So this is basically what the Rambam's talking about, a spaklaria. And he says, that kind of a glass is that has a curvature that gives a false impression from the other side because of the curvature. This is what's called spaklaria. And the Rambam says this is based on the laws of physics. Why does it happen? Why, if you have a pane of glass, you see exactly the other side what there is? But if the lens is curved, it's going to be different. Because the Rambam is familiar with refraction of light. He's familiar with it. And that's exactly what happens. When you have refraction of light, it means that light bends. And by bending, depending on the angle of the bending, that's the distortion that you're going to see. So the Rambam says this clearly. He says, "Uperusha riya misupeket." It's distorted vision of you. Lefisha roe mechoe masach shel zchuchit. Because though anybody seeing beyond this screen, this glass of screen glass, o shehem o kol davar shakuf zulatam eino ro'eh b'mkomo amduyak. You're not seeing exactly the way it looks like. It's distorted. Kefi shemitbarer b'mada'ei hara'ut, as is mentioned in the books of optics. Means the Rambam in the Mishnah commentary studied physics. This is physics, laws of physics, and then he digresses. Because the minute he hears the word spaklaria, ooh, that reminds me of something that our Chachamim said about the difference between the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu as opposed to the prophecy of all the other prophets. What is he referring to? Chachamim say that Moshe Rabbeinu was the only prophet to see the vision clearly, and the phrase that's used by Chazal, aspaklaria mi'ira, transparency. As opposed to all the other prophets, they saw the vision via aspaklaria she'eina me'ira, which in English we'd call translucent. Translucent is a type of glass you'd use in a shower room or a bathroom where obviously you don't want people to see. So it's like foggied out. Fine. So the Chazal used that phrase, aspaklaria, in this way, distorted vision or clear vision. Now, this has nothing to do with the Mishnah of the 30th chapter of Maseret Kelim, but there's an association of the word spaklaria with that great idea. Now, it's such a great idea that when the Rambam writes the 13 principles of Yahadut in the last chapter of Maseret Sanhedrin, that becomes poetically put into the Siddur under the name of Ani Ma'amin, Ani Ma'amin, Ani Ma'amin, the 13 Yesodot, which then in the 16th century an Italian poet writes Yigdal. Yigdal is nothing but a poetic rendition of the 13 attributes. So you have an Ani Ma'amin that you have to believe in prophecy, and you have another Ani Ma'amin that you believe in the unique prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu. So it is a very fundamental idea in Yahadut. So here the Rambam has an excuse to talk about it in the 30th chapter of Maseret Kelim, because the word spaklaria surfaced as a type of glass vessel. And it reminded him of the Ma'amar Chazal, Aspaklaria Me'ira, and Aspaklaria She'ena Me'ira. And at the end of source number 2, he apologizes why he got off the tangent there. He says, Kvar Haragnu Minyan Alacha. You know, I know this has nothing to do with the Mishnah that we're talking about. Aval Be'arnu Inyan Nifla. But, you know, I just explained something really nice. Now let's get to the Rambam as a physician. So already last week, 2 weeks ago, we talked about the fact that Chazal give us the green light to heal, to be involved in the healing process, based on the pasuk in Parshat Mishpatim, Verapo Yerape. You know, there's this religion called Christian Science that believes that if God wants you to be sick, you ought to be sick. And if God wants you to die from your illness, you die from the illness. But you're not supposed to have any human intervention to change God's will. Of course, Yahadut does not agree with this. This is a big issue in the United States where, people were taken to the U.S. Supreme Court on this because people claim it's my religion. And, freedom of religion. And if I'm supposed to die from this illness, I'm supposed to die. And obviously the medical services and society at large did not buy into it. Says we're not going to allow this to happen. So Yadut says clearly, Verapo Yerape, the Gemara says in Masechet Baba Kama, Mikan Nitan Rishut L'Rofei L'Rapot. So there's permission granted for the physician to heal. The Rambam thinks that the word Rishut is too modest. He wants to use a sharper expression. So sort number 3, in the underline, it says Shechayav Harofei Min Adin LeRapot Chole Yisrael. It's not just Rishut; it's not permission granted, but it's obligatory. It's obligatory to heal, and it's not something that is optional. You have to heal, and the subject at hand in Masechet Nedarim, in source number 3, has to do with. I think we actually touched on this 2 weeks ago. If a person has a fallout with a neighbor, a broges. These things happen sometimes, I know you don't believe it, but sometimes neighbors don't get along with each other. And you're so angry with the neighbor that you make a neder, a promise that you don't have anything to do with this guy. You don't talk to him, you never see him, never look at him, everything. Turns out the man gets sick, and you happen to be a physician. So the halacha is that even though you made an oath not to have any dealings with him, but as a physician, you're obliged to heal. You're obliged to intervene and heal because it's an obligation. Chayav arofei min adin lirapot chole Yisrael. And it's interesting where the Rambam derives this from, because he doesn't take it from verapo yirape, which you would expect in Parshat Mishpatim, where there the Gemara does say mikan nitan reshut lirofei lirapot. The reason the Rambam doesn't take it from there is because the context is not illness. The context is physical damage. There, two people had a fight, and in the fight, he ended up breaking his arm. In the fight, he ended up injuring him, the person. The person fell, and he got injured. So it wasn't that he fell, took ill. So you might argue and say, when a person is injured, then, of course, there's room to try to heal him. But if a person took ill, how do you know that you're allowed to, that you're obligated to heal? So the Rambam derives it from somewhere else, from the mitzvah of Hashavat Aveda, returning lost articles. Because if a person is sick, so his health is lost. And when you cure him, you have restored his health. So it comes from Hashavat Aveda. Take a look at the end of source number 3, after the underline. Harehu bichlal omram beferush. This Ferush HaKatuv. This is what the Pasuk says. V'hashevota lo, and you shall return it. Lerabot et gufo, even his health. She'im ra'ata oved v'yachol la'atzil. If you see that his health is going kaput, you can help him, you save him. Hareze matzilo b'gufo o b'mono o b'yidiyato. You have to physically take the time to help him, which means, let's assume, somebody has to be brought to the hospital. So you're not a doctor, but if he's not brought to the hospital, he may die. But you have a car, and you're not going to wait around for the ambulance, so you'll take him. Or you'll put him in a cab, and you'll pay for the cab ride to the hospital. So that's something that you have to do if you're going to save him. You're going to say, no, it's going to cost me too much money, 50 shekel to Hadassah, you know, that's too much money to save the guy. You're not allowed to say that. You have to pay the money. You can't tell the guy, cabbie, you know, here, this guy, take him to the hospital, it's an emergency, you know. A cab driver who says, I want to get paid for it. Who's going to pay for the ride? You tell the person who just was hit in an accident in a car, you have money, you have a credit card, you know. And now's not the time. I remember once on the road from Alonshfut to Yerushalayim, I was driving by, and all of a sudden there was a bump, there was a traffic jam, there was an accident. And as we're passing by, I see that a friend of mine, somebody who I knew, was actually hurt in the accident. And go wait around for an ambulance back in 1979. It wasn't so easy. So the person was able to be put into my car, and I drove to Hadassah. And I drove right next to the emergency room, ran inside to get some orderly to bring out a wheelchair, and had the person brought to the emergency room. By the time I came out, I got a ticket. Okay, got a ticket, 200 shekel fine, whatever, you park in a no parking zone. And the only reason I parked there is because I needed to be right next to the emergency room door. So I wrote a letter to the judge. I wrote a letter, because you're allowed to, respond, appeal. So I wrote a letter and I explained exactly this is the circumstance. And I said, look, if it costs me 200 shekel to do a chesed, so let it be, that's all. I'm just explaining what happened, that's all. So they canceled the fine. Yeah, all right. That was nice. That was nice. They didn't have to, but that's what they did. All right. Now we're going to look at source number 4. Another, I don't remember if we did this 2 weeks ago, the source number 4, because this is not the same page, but I know some of the things were on it. I don't know if we got to this page. With the Chizkiyahu who hid the book of Refuot, we did talk about it. Maybe I've talked about it. Why the Rambam insisted what kind of a book it was that Chizkiyahu hid, who Ganaz Sefer Refuot, and Chachamim applauded it, but there was this opinion out there that Shlomo Melech had authored a medical digest, and people were using it instead of davening, and Chizkiyahu said, okay, no more book, and now you just have to say Tillim. Rambam thought this was an outrageous explanation, and the Rambam feels that just as when you have hunger pangs, and you thank God for food that solves your hunger pang, so too we're supposed to thank God that He sent physicians and medical researchers who have successfully come up with remedies and treatment, and you have to thank God for that, for sure, no doubt. Okay, and that too, he explains with an apologetic comment in the middle of source number 4, V'loherachti l'daber binyan zeh, he's apologizing why he's being so expansive here, because he heard this ridiculous perush and he felt he had to reject it. Okay, let's jump to number 5. And number 5 is very, very important. It's in Masechet Yoma, and it deals with Yom Kippur issues, but also with Shabbat issues. So we know that Pikuach Nefesh Doche Shabbat, if there's a life-threatening situation, so you're allowed to do something on Shabbat, you're allowed to violate Shabbat or violate Yom Kippur in order to save a person's life. This everybody knows, it's axiomatic. Now the question is, what are you doing to save a person's life medically? So the Rambam says the only thing medical that you're allowed to do to save a person's life on Shabbat is that which has been proven to be medically and scientifically sound. But if it's hocus pocus, that you would entail some type of act of Chil Shabbos, you're not allowed to do that. So look at source number 5. Chachamim Amrim, Ein Omrin Al Mitzvah, Ela Beripui Bilvad. That you're only allowed to save a person on Shabbat something that's considered an accepted medical treatment. Beripui Bilvad Shu Davar Barur Shahigayon VaNisayon HaPashut Mechayvim Oto. That has passed the test of experimentation. And it makes sense. It's logical. It's scientifically proven. So this is a type of treatment that you're allowed to use. For example, let's assume there's a need for an ultrasound or you know some type of gadgetry that involves Chilul Shabbat. And no doubt the doctors know that they have to use this machinery on Shabbat. Well, this is what they do on Tuesday, so you do it on Shabbat also. But let's assume you have some type of machine that gives off some type of hocus-pocus sounds, and if you hear this sound over and over again, you're going to be healed. The Rambam says, there's no basis, scientific basis, for this kind of treatment. So you're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos or Yom Kippur using this kind of treatment. What's interesting is that against this viewpoint, the Rashba is Rabbi Shlomo Ben Aderet. He's a student of the Ramban in Barcelona. And Rashba says, okay, the reason that the Rambam says that there has to be scientifically approved methods that we use in the saving of a person on Shabbat Yom Kippur, because only that will really save, and hocus pocus is not really something that's going to save. So Rashba says, but the hocus pocus also works, he says. And if the hocus pocus works, why can't I use it on Shabbat Yom Kippur? So he challenges what the Rambam is saying here. He says, what's the bottom line? It works. So if it works, it works. Of course, I don't know exactly what the hocus pocus the Rashba is talking about, but the Rambam makes his point here that it has to be scientifically valid.
The placebo effect.
Right, so there's a placebo effect, nachon, that's true, that sometimes you do things for a person, and even though what you're doing is completely useless, but psychologically, it impacts on a person, and could have positive value, right? Correct? Okay. And now we'll just move on to source number 6. So here, the Rambam's getting in source number 6 and 7 into women's issue, gynecological issues, and reproduction issues. So he talks about what brings about the pregnancy of a male fetus or female fetus. Why does the fetus become male, ultimately a boy and a man, and or a female, a girl or a woman, and then a woman? Why does this happen? At what stage in the gestation process does this happen? So the Rambam says, they have to realize this is all before microscopic biology. I mean, to even comment about this 850 years ago is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. So I happen to have a daughter who's a gynecologist, you know, and we went over this material to see where the Rambam, you know, is guessing, or where the Rambam is on sound scientific footing. So here he says, V'teva isha im nivla'a v'egia zera limkomo harehu ma'amid et ha'chomer ha'nimtza sham u'mitaveh u'bar kemo shemuvu'ar b'madei ha'teva. So here the Rambam actually has it pretty correct as to exactly at what place in the woman's womb does the pregnancy actually begin. He has it right. Now, this is before anatomy was studied the way it's studied today, with surgical incisions and autopsies, so doctors are able to clearly and very capably understand the anatomy of a body. And here, the Rambam is making statements that it's not really guesswork, but has a lot to do with pretty much understanding how the systems work. And to a large degree, he's actually right. There is a great physician, Dr. Fred Rosner, who published a few books together with Rabbi Moshe Tendler on medical ethics. So Dr. Fred Rosner wrote a book on the Rambam in medicine, and trying to examine how much of the Rambam's medical writings are correct in terms of modern medicine. So he comes up with approximately 50% of what the Rambam wrote is absolutely correct, 25% question mark, maybe yes, maybe no, and 25% nonsense in terms of today's medicine. Well, that's pretty good, considering we're talking about somebody who lived over 800 years ago and with the medical knowledge of the day. That's very, very good. So if you take a look at the second page, source number 7, here the Rambam is talking about infertility, which is also a subject that my daughter deals with, and fertility issues. In order to treat infertility, so the Rambam says, Gormei miniyat haleida, rabim yiduim etzel orfim. The reasons for infertility are known by the doctors. Yesh shahagorem lekach ma'ish bulvad. Sometimes the problem is the man. O me'isha bulvad. Sometimes the problem is in the woman. O mishneim yachad. Sometimes it's both sides. So in order to deal with fertility issues, the first order of business is to isolate where's the problem. So take this week's parsha. Right? So Rivka is akara. Rivka is barren, which means she's infertile. What about Yitzchak? Does Yitzchak have a problem? Is the problem on Yitzchak's side? Or is the problem on Rivka's side only? Are there any indications in the Chumash that we can make such a judgment? One thing is clear with Avraham and Sarah, Avraham was not infertile at all. Because the moment Hagar enters into the picture, it didn't take long and Avraham's an Abba. He's already a father. We call him Avraham Avinu, right? But he's our patriarch, right? So one of my sons, we moved out to Be'er Sheva, so he was in kindergarten, the first grade. They were learning Chumash. They were learning biblical advice, you know, Chumash stories, parasha stories. He was in kindergarten yet. He comes home and he says, Anachnu lebadu al Avraham Avinu. Okay, fine. We learned about Avraham Avinu. Very nice. He says, Bagan yesh lanu gam kein Avraham. We also have a kid, Avraham. Avo lo korim lo Avinu. His name's not Avinu. Korim lo Mazuz. He's Avraham Mazuz. Lo korim lo Avinu. That was very cute. He's not Avraham Avinu. Right?
It wasn't his
father. Right. It's like they say, how do you know that Moshe Rabbeinu was Sephardi, not Ashkenazi? Because if it would have been Ashkenazi, it would have been Moshe Rabinovich. Rabbeinu was more of a Sephardi name. Right. So what can we learn from Avraham Avinu? That he was not infertile at all. And you know, what do we know about Avraham Avinu after Sarah dies? Not much. The Rav always pointed out that Avraham Avinu leaves the stage of history when his wife Sarah dies. Because from the purpose of the Avot, it's a couple. So it's Avraham and Sarah. It's Yitzchak and Rivka. So the minute Sarah is out of the picture, Avraham's also gone. And the only thing left in Parshat Chayei Sarah is to guarantee that the next generation is going to have an appropriate shidduch for Yitzchak. That's all. And then almost as a passing thought, he marries Keturah, and there's a brit every year. He's an old man, but... And he has this one and that one and this one and that one. And next thing you know, he's got a ton of kids. So Avraham Avinu didn't have a fertility issue. The issue was by Sarah. Okay. But what's the story with Yitzchak and Rivka? Was Yitzchak a problem? So it says, Vayetar Yitzchak l'nochach ishto ki akarahi. That Yitzchak davens opposite his wife, for she was barren. In other words, the Torah indicates that the issue was by Rivka. She was barren, and she required a special divine intervention. Today, when we talk about the fertility clinic, so I say again, the first thing that has to be determined before any type of treatment takes place is where's the issue, where's the problem? Is it the man, is it the woman, or is it both? And on the basis of the answers, that's when the treatment is prescribed. So here, the Rambam knows that. And my daughter told me that this is pretty fascinating that 800 years ago, the Rambam was able to make such a definitive statement. Now, what's interesting also, the Rambam calls it, he says, it's known by the doctors. So why wasn't it known by the European doctors? Which doctors is he talking about? He's talking about Muslim doctors. You know, in the days of the Rambam, there was a lot of positive symbiotic relations between Jews and Muslims. It's not that they were at our throats day in and day out. So on the level of academics, of study, philosophers, medicine, and so on, the Rambam had Muslim teachers. And he studied by Muslim physicians. So that's not a problem. But all of their works are in Arabic. The Rambam wrote all of his works in Arabic. So whether Judeo-Arabic or regular Arabic at the time, these works never made it to Europe. And nobody took the pains in the halls of academia in Europe to translate, to get their hands on this material. So they're starting from how to create the wheel a second time and come to the scientific truths independently from where the North African Muslim scientists knew. And it's a real shame because we lost a lot of time in Europe because they were not proficient in the material that was known already in the days of the Rambam. You take a look at source number 8. 8 is actually very fascinating. Very fascinating.
8.
It's from Masechet Bechorot. Now here is a Mishnah that tells us, and I'm qualifying from the beginning, we're going to deal with the analysis of a halachic viewpoint that's not lahalacha, which means whatever the Mishnah is talking about, it's based on a view of Rabbi Shimon that the bottom line is it's not halacha. The Mishnah says that there is a possible scenario that in the same family, the same husband and wife, the wife is going to give birth to two children, both of them are going to be a firstborn. How can two people be a firstborn? Well, one is a firstborn. A bechor. So, one second. You have this week's parsha, so you have twins. One is going to be the bechor. So who's the bechor? Esav's the bechor. Now, whether the bechorah, the firstborn status, is a negotiable and marketable item, that's a different story. You see in the Chumash that Yaakov purchases the bechorah, or the rights of the bechorah, for a pot of bean soup. Nizid Adashim. Does that work? Can that work today? I happen to know somebody who was a Kohen and not religious, and there was an issue with a girlfriend who was a divorcee, a grusha. Now, a Kohen does not allow to marry a grusha. If a Kohen marries a grusha, the nisuin, the chasana, the chatunah is valid. It is valid, except that the children born out of that relationship are going to be Kohen halal. They can be invalid Kohanim. But up front, we would not sanction the marriage of a Kohen and a grusha. So this fellow honestly wants to sell his kahuna, because if Esav can sell his bechorah and Yaakov's willing to pick it up for Nizid Adashim, why can't he sell his kahuna? It's a valid question. It's not going to work, but the question is, how did it work with regard to Yaakov and Esav? But here, the Mishnah is talking about a possibility where in the same family, it is more than one bechor. Now, by Yaakov Avinu, that actually happened in his family. For the simple reason, he had four wives. So each one of the wives had a firstborn. So the question is, who becomes the principal bechor? So who was the firstborn, literally the firstborn? It was Reuven. He was the first one born from Leah. And so much so that in Parshat Vayechi, when Yaakov Avinu gives the brachot, he begins with Reuven bechori ata, you are my firstborn. So the Abarbanel tells us in his Perush that Reuven is really the big loser from all the 12 tribes. I mean, big time loser. Because he was supposed to have three different responsibilities. I was going to say honors, but really responsibilities. As the firstborn, there's a responsibility, number one. Number two, he was going to be the tribe of the Kohanim as the firstborn. And number three, he was also going to be the Melech, the political leader. He lost the Melucha to David, which is Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda becomes the king. He lost the kuhuna to Levi. Levi becomes the Kohanim. And he lost the Bechorah, firstborn rights, to Yosef. Yosef. As the Now, Yosef is the firstborn of Rachel, born much later. He's born almost at the end of the game, after most of the other tribes are born. So, in Parshat Zot HaBracha, where Moshe Rabbeinu talks about the all the Shvatim as well, so he refers to Yosef as Bechor Shoro Hadarlo V'Karnei Re'im Karnav. So Yosef is referred to as the Bechor. So why, in what respect is Yosef the Bechor? So we know that the Bechor enjoys in the inheritance two shares. And that's not just because, you know, what a lucky boy, he was born the first one, he gets two shares. You have to realize in time of old, if a father, the head of the household, died young, or let's say a divorce is out of the picture, there was a need for a surrogate father in the house. Because the mother, it wasn't like today, the mother is a career person, has a job, and so on. It wasn't like that at all. So somebody had to pick up the slack. Somebody had to be responsible for the financial welfare of the family. And it was the firstborn, because he was the oldest. And because the firstborn, the oldest, had an extra share, had an extra responsibility, so the Torah grants him an extra share of the inheritance. So Yosef receives up front two shares of Eretz Yisrael. And that's why his tribe divides into Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh, Keruven v'Shimon Yuli, as the Pasuk says in Parshat Vayechi. Which means Yosef receives Pishnayim, two portions of the inheritance of the land of Eretz Yisrael. So that's the first halakha of Bechor, that the Bechor is entitled to a double portion of the inheritance. And the second is Pidyon HaBen, the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. So the Mishnah says, there can be a scenario in a family where two of the sons are Bechor, one for the purpose of Nachala, inheritance, and one for the purpose of Pidyon HaBen. How could that work? How can you have two sons? So if take a look what the Rambam says here. Efsharut davar zeh lidati, the only possibility that I can think of, he says, shetehei ha'isha muberet b'shnayim. Let's start the case. The woman is expecting twins. Right? Yeah, she's carrying twins. And there's a complication in the pregnancy. V'ka'u et dafna, and they do a cesarean. And this is going back 2,000 years, 800 years. This is not modern medicine here. They make an incision in her abdomen, and hotziu echad mehem. They take one of the babies out. So therefore, that baby is the first one that was technically born. So he's a bechor. V'acharkach, and as this all is happening, yatza sheni kederach olam. The other one is born naturally, comes out naturally, not through the incision in the abdomen. So the Rambam is saying, the first one is the Bechor for Nachala, for inheritance, because in fact he's the firstborn, but he's not the Petarechem. Petarechem is the status that obligates in the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. So the second one actually came out naturally, is the Petarechem, so it was the Bechor for the mitzvah of Pidyon HaBen. This is the Rambam says could happen, but the mother's not going to be there for the Pidyon, because she's going to die. Umeita acharei yitziat hasheni. She's for sure going to die after the birth of that second one. Why will she die? So first of all, I found out that in time of old, cesareans were done almost always as a postmortem. The mother was pregnant deep into the ninth month and didn't survive the childbirth. In order to perhaps save the unborn, they would make an incision and try to save the unborn. And give it a chance. So sometimes the baby would live, sometimes the baby wouldn't live. But the mother was essentially dead. Or they would do this very shortly before the mother would die. So in essence, the mother would die from the operation anyway, because they had no way of closing her up and preventing infection. There was no antibiotics and so on. So really, this mother didn't have a chance at all. At all. But the Rambam thinks that if the Mishnah talks about a scenario of Yesh Bechor LeNachala V'Yesh Bechor LePidyon, there's got to be a scenario that physically this can happen. But then the Rambam says, Avo Mashe Mesaprim BaSipurim, what's being told in the storybooks, in Yiddish we would say, Bubamaisis, right, Sipurei Safta, That actually what happened was, it was one baby in utero, and they did an incision in the abdominal area, we call a cesarean section, and then afterwards she survives it, and not only survives it, v'teharah, she gets pregnant later on down the road, v'telaid, and then she has a child, naturally. Eini yodea lekach hesber, v'hu davar mufla ma'od. I have no explanation for something like that. That's wild. That can't happen. Because no such woman is going to survive this kind of operation, let alone get pregnant again, let alone have a natural delivery. This is not going to happen. So Rav Kapach, that's all, the Yemenite Dayan, who edits this edition of the Rambam's Perush HaMishnah, comments, what to the Rambam was Nifla Ma'od is Ma'asim B'chol Yom today. And I can tell you that I have a daughter-in-law in my family who had a cesarean the first time around and subsequently had 4 natural children afterwards. And it's nothing out of sync. Yeah, Fakshar Rivka.
They wouldn't have a pigeon up
in. So. Right. You, no, today, that's a very valid point. So if, let's assume today, a mother has a cesarean, and it's a boy, let's say it's a boy, and that boy is going to be the Bechor for inheritance, and then, you know, she heals, she recuperates. So a lot of times the doctors will tell the mother to hang on a year, at least 2 years, whatever it is, but she can have more children, and a boy is born next. So would that boy have a pigeon of Ben? So that's why I said 5 minutes ago that this mission is not lehalacha, because the psak is that the second one is not going to have a pigeon aven. But according to the Tana, Rabbi Shimon, the second one, who's born naturally, will have a pigeon aven. That's the expression, yesh b'chor le'pidyon v'yesh b'chor le'nachala. And the Rambam's just racking his brains to try to find a realistic scenario that this could even happen. And the answer is that in today's modern day and age, it can happen. It can happen, and it happens. It happens, absolutely can happen. In the case of my daughter-in-law, that wouldn't happen because the first one who was born by cesarean was a boy and all the others were girls. So, but girls, yeah. But it can happen. Yeah, not only was the boy born by cesarean, but he was preemie by 2 months. And I remember we knew my daughter-in-law was going in early to the hospital on a Friday, and my wife and I jumped into the car and we were going to go to Hadassah, see what's going on there. And as we're driving that last stretch down to Hadassah, that windy road, phone rings in the car. My wife answers. My son says, "Mazel Tov, Safta." It was the first grandson that we had. So, and my wife's eyes started rolling because in her line of work in the hospital, she deals with hearing issues, which are part of developmental issues with preemies. Sometimes it's not 100%. Baruch Hashem, the bunch of them has been very kind to us, and this. This past bar mitzvah boy already is quite developed. Quite, yeah. Baruch Hashem. But I'm just saying is that this can happen today. And this is what the Rambam says. And with Rav Kapa comments, yeah, to the Rambam it was muflamot, which tells us that Baruch Hashem, we have to thank God that how much medicine has advanced today, that we can now not only have healthy children, but we can now explain a Mishnah even better. Isn't that nice? Yeah, Baksha.
Two issues came up, referring to what you do to heal on Shabbat. Alina went into the hospital and refused the fetal monitor for the infant because it was Shabbat and the baby died.
Well, I was just going to say that's ridiculous because
that's
it's...
All right. Then when I was visiting somebody in New York and on Friday night she started getting heart palpitations.
Yeah.
Now, how do you decide when you go to your next door neighbor who's a guy and ask him to take you to the hospital?
Why a guy?
Should I have taken her to the
Rambam says, "Lo nochri." He says, "Eladei gedolei Yisrael v'chach mehem."
Would I be able to go back?
So that's a different question. That's a different question. But the Rambam says, "Don't look for a goy. You should do it." He says very clearly. So if a person is driving someone to the hospital and would not have done it unless the person has a heter to come back home, then you're allowed to drive home too. But if the person would You know, if it's like just a few hours before the end of Shabbos, it's no big deal. So is it Friday night? So that's where the issue comes up, right? Okay, so I'd be happy to collect it. If you put the pages in the back, I'll bring them next week, because there's still a lot to do yet on this. On this page.